Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this ninth day of December 2025, 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Very nice to have you with us. And I thank you all for being here on a really cold day. It was cold. I had a minus on my dashboard, believe it or not. And hopefully you're keeping warm and doing the best you can. It was it's been up and down, so now we're in the down spot. But hopefully, you know, keep warm. That's all we can do. Let me introduce our group today, and we'll get started. Heather Mulligan is here, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
I caught you off guard.
I'm very cold.
I think we're on 4, Mike, in this case, but I can put her on 5. Here we go.
Okay.
Here, you have your choice. You have 3 mics.
Wow, I feel so privileged.
Yes, 3 mics.
It's a 3 mic morning. That's, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
I'm cold. It was cold in the barn this morning, and anytime it's below 10, I try not to even pay attention to what it is, but try and remember my Scandinavian mantra, which I am a quarter Scandinavian, which is there is no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothes.
Oh, that's true. Yes, not appropriate for those temperatures. Yes,
I just say it to myself over and over again.
It's a good thing to keep in mind. I agree with that. We also welcome Judy Patrick to the program, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor for the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. Hello, Judy.
Good morning. It is cold. You know, I like to run in the cold, but I run with my sister. And I have a sister who will plunge into the bat and kill, like, early in the spring, late in the fall. But yesterday it was too cold for her to run.
Really?
Yeah.
I always see you running around town. You two are always out there.
Once you start running, you warm right up. But yeah, for some reason, she's not running the last few days.
I always say the same thing. Kelly and I look at each other and say, well, good for them. Do you want to do it? No.
So I've always had the 19-degree rule. Like, you shouldn't run under 19 degrees outside. And for whatever reason, my brother, who is military, always says, like, it's bad for your lungs to run if it's under 19 degrees. And it's also the temperature at which I blanket my horses.
Yeah.
Except for the fat one, I wait until it's like 15 for him.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. I agree with you entirely. I have the 19 rule, too. I haven't run since I was 19. Mike Spain is here, former Times Union associate editor. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. It is cold. My wife, Debbie, and I went out walking yesterday, did 4 miles in the sunshine. It was cold.
Yeah, but you go out and you do it.
You do it, you know, and it was
very nice.
And you sort of warm up.
my wife and I spent a beautiful weekend in the city of New York. We were enjoying all of the holiday sights, and we walked quite a bit. And it was Sunday was warmer than Monday, but it was lovely. And you get it.
But it's down south. It's a little warmer down there.
Yes,
isn't it?
It was. It absolutely was. As I mentioned, I was out yesterday, and over the weekend we reported the loss of a dear member of our roundtable family, and we learned of the passing of Vera Carius Kelly, who was a panelist on this program for well over 10 years, and such a meaningful part of our program. We did mention the story on Sunday, and Sarah did a beautiful job remembering her yesterday at the top of the show. I just wanted to, if you'll indulge me, I just wanted to say a couple of things about Vera and her passing. It's cliche. I know it's cliche, but we consider ourselves here, those of us who do this in the panel, as a family, and we're dysfunctional, but we're a family, and I think it's impossible when you spend 2 hours a day talking to each other about the most consequential, important, drastic issues of our time that you're going to learn a lot about each other. You're going to learn a lot about people's backgrounds and thoughts and what their read is on a certain situation. Also, by the way, sometimes we just talk about really stupid stuff, and a lot falls into that category too. And you learn from that, as well. So it's natural that we become very, very good friends, and this is a wonderful family. The greatest thing that ever happened to me on the show is that I've met the people that are on day in, day out. All three of the individuals in the studio today have been on the show for years. Hell, I think Mike came with the show. And
by default, yeah.
Yes. we made out in that deal. But it does hit hard, and it's a devastating loss. There's no question about it. It's a devastating loss to have her no longer with us. That is devastating. She had a prolonged illness, cancer, that she had been fighting for so long, and that was devastating. Watching her go through that over time was devastating. The ups and the downs of that, and of course, anyone who's ever gone through it, anyone who has ever had anyone they love or care for has gone through it, knows just how painful it is. I will say that Vera had this, we were talking about it before we went on the air, that she had this ability to take the time that she was feeling good, or taking the moments that were available to her to enjoy nature and enjoy her friends and enjoy her family, and to make the most of those times, and to work as hard as she possibly could to get better, and to welcome therapies and new ideas and things that could possibly leave her with us longer. But over the long term, it's devastating when you think of just how long it was, but it's also was quite inspirational to see how she made use of that time. When I talk about family, we all are missing Vera, of course, very, very much. Vera, for those of you who don't know, was from Germany. She was the professor of comparative politics at Siena University, and a position she held for a long time, and was so influential in many corners of this community, and did so much work both through the university and through other various organizations and causes. But when we talk about family, I think of we're all impacted, obviously. But one of the things that I first thought of was her friendship with three of our panelists, Judith Enck, Teresa Bourgeois, and Fran Berman. Those four were the Hellfire Club. That's a force. You get those four together. And every once in a while, Teresa would say, can we all be on together? And I thought, ooh, because they like this whole like good trouble idea. And I, okay, great. But the thing I loved about it is, they were just fantastic together. And then they would invite me out to lunch with them. I was like the token guy. And it was those lunches and seeing the spirit of those four women and their fierce dedication to making this world a better place was so inspirational, and in how they worked off each other. So I think of, and I did, I was in contact with them this weekend, but Judith and Fran and Teresa and how they're taking this loss as well. So I think of them this morning. I think when somebody passes like this, it's always you always take a moment. I think most of us do anyway. You take a moment to think of what impacted you about that person, of what was about that person that touched you in a way. And I thought of several things about Vera. I mean, I just first of all, just for the way that she used to fight with Alan, she'll always have my love and support. But that alone.
That made good radio.
Oh, my goodness, it made good radio. But you think of the things that really stand out. And the thing that came to me was, it was the first thing that I thought of, and then I tried to go deeper, and I just kept on coming back to it, and then I realized it really was, I think, the most important thing. And she was such a... She loved her students and her job so much. She would so often speak on behalf of her students and speak with great admiration and love and pride in what they had accomplished and what they were accomplishing, and had such hope. And she felt that they were our guiding star, really, to whatever we're trying to go to or get out of. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. I think people in education, and this isn't a diss, I'm right there with you sometimes, but you know, sometimes when you talk about your students, the eyeballs tend to roll back. You know, oh yeah, the students. Vera was never like that. She was always so proud of them and brought some in. We met many of her students over the years. But as I allowed that to extrapolate, I thought that how lucky we all were to be, because we're all her students. She taught all of us. She was an educator to us on this program. She was an educator to the listeners of this program, to those of us in this room. Her thoughts, her ideas on how there were possibilities and there were moments where we could move forward, and that the young people had the possibility or the real potential of moving roadblocks that we had put in place that could be permanently removed if they were allowed to, and that we had to do whatever we could do to make that possible. If that is the lasting memory that you leave, I think that's a pretty damn good memory. She was a lovely, beautiful person. The grace that she had through her illness and through her life was something that I will always remember and cherish. I will forever. I will miss her horribly, but I, as we all will, but I do know, and I said this when I was talking to the newsroom over the weekend, but I know she's with us so often because she's such a part of our conversation, because she really changed the way, at least I think, and a lot of us thought of issues and how we could move on and be in a better place. I send our love, the love of this show, the love of all of the people who have worked with her over the years, and we send that love to her family and also to the Siena University family, who's had twin tragedies over the last week, and which has been horrible. And so we think of them as well, and we... come together. This is never easy, but certainly around the holidays is dreadful as well. But send our love to Bill and to her family and to those traveling from Germany to come in and to see her and who were her with her when she died. So we shroud you with love and our great appreciation for sharing her with us. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We'll start the show. And by the way, if anyone has any messages or anything that you would like to send that you would like us to pass along to the family, you can just send it to our email, and we will make sure that they get it and see your responses as well. We'll be back in just a moment. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, and Heather Mulligan with us this morning. And we welcome your thoughts, your ideas, your outrage, whatever you wish to share with us this morning. We welcome it. Okay. So let's go to news. We learned that the Supreme Court seems to be poised to expand Trump's power over independent agencies. The justices seem likely to allow the president to fire a Democratic member of the Federal Trade Commission, a ruling that could limit or overturn a nine-decade-old precedent that insulated some agencies from political influence by the executive. This is reporting from the Washington Post. A ruling in favor of Trump's position has been widely expected by legal experts because the justices have been chipping away for years at the precedent known as Humphrey's executor. Many of the Supreme Court's conservative justices have expressed support for an idea known as unitary executive theory, which holds that the Constitution gives the president broad authority to fire officials and that Congress cannot limit it. During arguments Monday, Chief Justice John Roberts referred to Humphrey's executor as a dried husk. The contemporary FTC bears little resemblance to the one that existed at the time of the High Court's 1935 ruling that insulated its commissioners from removal by the precedent by the president without cause because it now exercises significant executive powers, he said. Conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh said independent agencies lack accountability. Heather.
Yeah, this is a real test of how government is structured. I think there's a lot of agreement that they're very likely to find that he does have the ability here to fire people. These agencies are very intentionally structured to be bipartisan, which is something I've always kind of questioned because that presupposes a two-party system. If you say that the appointments have to be made by Republicans and Democrats, then, you know, why, how could you ever have a true independence party have any kind of influence in these agencies? But setting that aside for a moment, I think it's a very interesting problem because the next one obviously is going to be the Federal Reserve, right? And I think there's been some attempt, I think, in narrative to make a distinction. I don't know that that's really a legal distinction. So if they do find he has unfettered ability to fire people who are appointed on an intentional, bipartisan, staggered term basis, they're not independent anymore. These agencies are no longer independent. They're executive. The appointment powers are more like having, you know, a Senate confirmation or something as a requirement, which he's trying to get around right now with his U.S. attorneys, right? So all of these controls are being tested. And this is, I'll go back to the, you know, we can say that if the Supreme Court rules one way or the other, that it's because of partisan loyalty. I don't believe that. I believe that it's how you look at the law and how you interpret it, which makes people lean one way or the other. I hope that someone comes up with a more cogent argument as to why, even though they're exercising what appears to be executive authority, that has been delegated to the legislature, and that's how these independent agencies are intended to be structured. But I don't think that argument was made in court, so I'm not optimistic.
Right. Mike Spain.
Yeah, I mean, I was impressed to hear the argument or the comments by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, the newest member of the court. She said that by destroying these independent entities, these agencies that Congress established to be bipartisan, basically just throwing out people who you may not agree with and appointing people who are of your own political point of view, you're going to lose expertise, you're going to lose objectivity. These were set up the way they were set up, flawed perhaps. You know, Heather, you make a good point, but whatever, they were set up not to be decimated when the presidency changes and when a different party is in the White House. I mean, it was a Democratic president 90 years ago that tried to push and fire everybody on the Federal Trade Commission. That was Franklin Roosevelt. And he was pushed back by this compromise that the Supreme Court came up with. this Humphreys executor decision. And, presidents, Eisenhower and Nixon were Republicans, Reagan, Bushes, the two Bushes all went by it, and so did the Democrats. They were all bound by it, and they honored it. They certainly would push their own candidates when a vacancy would come along, but it gave stability and some level of independence, which was the intent of Congress. But you're right. I mean, it's all about how you look at the Constitution and you look at the law and you look at executive power. And it seems from the questions and comments made by the conservative members of the court that they're poised to either weaken or just completely throw out that ruling 90 years ago that has kind of kept things intact.
Right. That seems clear. And the only issue will be whether or not the Federal Reserve will be affected as well. It seemed clear from Justice Kavanaugh's comments that he is concerned about this. You know, throughout my life, the administrative state has always been almost like a separate branch of the government. You know, that operates outside the Congress, the judiciary and the president. But diminishing that is something that conservatives have long sought, and sometimes for good reason, because they believe that the democratic process should have some influence over how these agencies operate. But like Mike, I worry about the continuity or the from administration to administration. What if the next person comes in and wants to change it entirely? I think businesses rely on some stability. They want to know that the rules about consumer protection finance are going to be the same going forward. Maybe they're more adaptable than I think, but it seems clear that this, this movement towards an imperial presidency, for good or for bad, is going to continue under this Supreme Court for many years to come.
It's this idea of the headline being that you're giving the president more power, and this is just one more thing. This is one more step, right? I mean, that's the important part to realize. But there seems to be, especially coming from the Supreme Court, so many of these incremental steps that adding up is. I was struck by the idea of this dried husk.
Yeah.
I mean, like, couldn't you say that? How much of that could you say from a 250-year-old document? I don't know.
That's only 90 years old.
Right. That, yes. But, I mean, just going back, I find that interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the Supreme. I mean, the conservative majority of the Supreme Court is the one that pretty much said a couple of years ago that the president is pretty much immune from anything he does, and he can pretty much do anything he wants as president. And Trump has taken that in his second time in the White House to as far as he possibly can, and he's pushing the envelope. But Judy mentioned, what happens if, let's say, there's a Democrat elected in 2028, and they come in, and he or she just wipes out all these agencies and puts in people that are, How is that going to bring stability to this country? And the independent agencies, it's almost like another branch of government. I mean, that's what critics have said or proponents have said. But it has brought stability. I can't even imagine if we were to, God forbid, have another pandemic right now, what this CDC and the FDA would be guiding us through. It wasn't good last time. It couldn't be that good this time. I mean, it's scary to think about it.
And I'll just say, I mean, I think to some degree, a lot of these independent agencies have, to some extent, become more activist in recent years, which draws more attention to, the degree to which they flex their authority. And I think if you look at the former FTC commissioner who's now working for Mayor Mamdani, that's Lena Khan, I mean, really attempted to do sweeping changes to antitrust in particular, the system under which our antitrust laws operate, and tried to switch it to sort of a European-style antitrust. Now, she was unsuccessful in doing that because I think there was, A, there was a ton of pushback, but B, she doesn't have legislative authority. But there's always this testing of powers between the agencies, and here you see the executive branch saying, nope, this is not going to happen. Whereas last round, it was Congress, right, that said, nope, you can't do this. There were lawsuits. She attempted to move forward with some non-compete provisions, actually, that were struck down in court. But there's this tension between independent agencies and the other branches of government, which I'm saying, like, they're not exactly squarely executive. That's historic. It's been going on for a very long time. And I think the real danger is not necessarily the moment right now giving this president too much power, although I think there's a danger in that, too. But the precedent of this rule applies to both sides. How are you going to like it when you have a president that you don't agree with, right? If you are on the conservative side of the aisle, if you're on the Republican side of the aisle and you think, well, we got to get rid of, you know, these heads of independent agencies because we don't like that they're not obeying the drumbeat of this administration. Well, what happens next time? I mean, their insulation that there's continuity in policy because of the bipartisan nature of the appointment process and because of the in air quotes, independence of these agencies. And you take that away, and you don't just take away continuity. You come up with a sort of a herky-jerky government where someone actually will have to serve four terms if they're going to have any kind of last, not four terms, two terms, 8 years, to have any kind of real lasting influence, because it's going to take you the first 2 years to get rid of all the people you don't like, replace them with people you do like, and then see how it works out. And by the way, as an aside, some of these policies that were seemingly like the great ideas are not working out so great so far. So, and I'm referring to tariffs.
Good tariffs, yeah. Right. We'll get into that as well. No, absolutely. We have some letters. We'll continue this conversation. We'll take a break. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Listening to the music of Rafael Itier, co-founder of the legendary salsa band El Gran Combo de Puerto Rico, who died over the weekend. He was 99 years old, 99, and a self-taught pianist, arranger, composer, music producer, and orchestra conductor, of which many consider to be the best salsa orchestra in the world. So we remember Rafael with the music going into our breaks this morning. Playlist is posted online, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. Some letters. Bruce says, it feels like the Republicans are quite determinedly driving the country at high speed into a brick wall, doing their best to destroy the federal government in ways that will take generations to undo. As an older person who has no realistic way to escape this country, it's terrifying. It feels like we're rapidly heading towards being a country like many so-called third world countries, where a few people live in a fabulous luxury while everyone else suffers and starves. That from Bruce. We go to Tony. My company is a majority export business, with China being a large export market for our product. The president's policies have largely closed that market off to us. This year, we have had to make over $100,000 in direct payment to the Treasury for tariffs. Now the government plans to take that money and give it to soybean farmers? How does this make any sense? And we'll get into the farming aid in just a few minutes, but it does, it certainly fits into what we're talking about here as well. Russ writes to us and says, the current case for allowing presidential leeway and firing FTC board members is the forerunner for similar power over the Federal Reserve appointments. There's no question that Trump wants to juice the economy in the same way as was done during the pandemic, and he will appoint people to do just that.
Yeah, and that did not have great consequences for us as well. Didn't that spark the inflation? Didn't that spark supply shortages? I mean, juicing the economy as a short-term fix, at the bottom line, he's going to be able to replace the Fed chairman come May anyway.
Yeah.
What is the rush? I think, but establishing the power is the point here. Initially, I thought that the president was just moving so quickly to get everything done at once, and then he was just going to enjoy the last 3 years of his term. But I think it's going to continue with this pace. The changes that are being asked for, the expansion of power, I think there is more coming down the road that we're just not, that just they haven't had time to get to, even though they've had time to get to a ton of things, except, I see that he's hitting the road today on the affordability issue.
Going to Pennsylvania.
We'll see how that goes.
Yep.
So it's not a hoax then?
Affordability?
It
was last week at 2:13 in the morning. I don't know about.
Yeah.
Right.
Now.
It's turned out it's just taking longer to fix it than previously expected.
The other part of this, too, is when we were talking about that power, but also the people will often say unchecked power. But and we can bring this up when we look into the story of the merger with Netflix and Warner Brothers and Paramount. But the personal wealth that is also being accumulated here on so many of these deals, quote unquote, that are taking place as a result. So I agree with you, Judy. Yes, so much is being done, but I think so much there are a couple of outcomes that are being sought, I think.
Indeed, and as a normal person, you have to wonder how much wealth is enough. And how much power is enough. Apparently, there is a level of human being where it's never enough. As someone who believes in the balancing powers between Congress and and the executive and the judiciary, it's stunning to see it shift so dramatically. I never even thought the judiciary had much power, but I've grown some respect for the power that it does have, as it, both at the circuit level and at the Supreme Court level. But the abandonment of Congress of any any power at all is stunning, and I think people need to speak up and tell them to at least, and it's interesting what Congress cares about. It's like, well, we're going to really step up on the Epstein files. We don't care about our inability to have any say over how the money is spent, but we're going to take a stand on this because it's a political issue. It just seems so wrongheaded and so dangerous for our society.
Well, I think Lord Acton, didn't think I'd be quoting him today, but I will.
I appreciate that you are.
19th century British historian and moralist is the person who is to whom the quote, absolute power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think he had it right. And I think that it's about wealth, but I think it's more about power, power and legacy. But also, I do think there is an urgency because I think there's almost no path for the Republicans to retain the majority in the House at the midterm. I just don't see it. I mean, it's history says no way. In fact, I would predict, and I'm just asterisks here. I'm usually wrong in my predictions, but I think there's going to be a huge swing in the House, and I just hope that what happens isn't a hyper focus on impeachments. Stop. Just actually use the power of the legislature and try and pursue that, because you're not going to get a removal, right? So
well, and it's not going to do us any good as a country.
Right.
I mean, it's just going to further damage what we have. I think I can't see where it's and what do you accomplish,
right? And I'm going to say I'm always encouraged by there's a very particular it's not this station, so I'm not going to say where, but a show that I listen to that is a very intentionally bipartisan political show about DC, and I'm always very encouraged when I hear individual members of Congress come on and talk about how They are working across the aisle to try and solve things like the healthcare affordability issue, right? And they have real plans. I mean, there is good stuff going on. We just don't hear it because it's not interesting to the news, really.
But getting it to move further with current leadership
is hard. They have to be brave.
And they have to be brave.
Yeah,
and,
they have to be brave. I mean, the
deck's in a secure district.
Right, yeah. And the deck is really stacked against them. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, there are people who are working really hard.
And there are people who are brave in both parties.
Yes.
There are a lot who are not. There are a lot who take, I think, the easy candy of just being hyper-partisan and just attacking people with labels. And I think that's really unfortunate because there are some really good people who are good policy thought leaders who are trying.
You know, but Judy asked the question of how much do you need? And, you know, once I get the FIFA Peace Prize, I'm good. I'm happy.
It's time to stop.
I actually thought that was fake.
It's a real prize.
It's the first one.
I know, right. But when I first saw it, I thought it was a spoof. I thought it was a complete...
Oh, it was an onion.
Because right, the first time I saw it was the Saturday Night Live thing. Hmm. I was, you know, like reading a really good book over the weekend, and so I wasn't paying attention to the news. And I thought, this can't be real. I mean, this is FIFA. Like, they were all corrupt. They were bought off. Like, you know... Yeah.
That continues. I mean, the FIFA has really played up to Donald Trump. They've, you know, they rent space in Trump Tower in New York City. They've given him all kinds of gold things. They've let him do the draw for the opening rounds of the World Cup. And they had the big gala at Kennedy Center, and he let them do it for free. I mean, it's...
But, I mean, weren't there multiple bribery convictions?
Yeah.
One of my...
it's not a pristine.
One of my law school classmates, who is actually a court of appeals judge now, was one of the prosecutors, I believe, in one of the earlier cases. And I was always like, oh, how cool is that? I mean, not cool that there's corruption, but, you know, yeah. Very smart person that I know was involved in it. My kids are huge soccer fans.
Yeah, and we all love soccer. Well, many of us love soccer. I do, too.
David writes to us and says the reason Trump and his proxy, SCOTUS, is rushing to get rid of Powell is that he wants to juice the economy. Second time we've heard juice as a verb this morning. Up the economy immediately so that his party might survive the midterm elections. Inflation likely will not roar back until after that election, and then it will be too late for the rest of us. That from David. We go to Guy, who says, dear panel, my understanding over the years has been that Congress passes legislation pertaining to executive agencies with, quote, little or zero detail about how they must run. That Humphreys allows the bureaucrats in those agencies to do what they please without interference from the president. If the Supreme Court overturns Humphreys' executive, can't Congress eliminate any increase in presidential power by drafting new legislation with details that force the president to act as Congress sees fit? While this may seem too difficult for Congress to achieve, it is technically, I believe, true. That from Guy.
I think the question is it more about the people or is it more about the actual structure of the rules? Because the structure of he's correct that the more detail that you give, the less flexibility. But the agencies don't have a lot of flexibility anymore after the decision around the EPA last year. And that I don't think was a completely incorrect decision. I mean, I think there are limits on executive authority, the ability of agencies to basically write their own legislation. The question here is the independence of the leadership of the authority because of who gets to appoint them. And that's what's being tested here.
Samuel tries to give us the lay of the land and says there seems to be a lot of assumptions that there will be a next president and that it could possibly be a Democrat. The entire goal of Project 2025 and the entire MAGA cult is that there will, from Trump forward, be a fascist authoritarian at the head of this country. Kevin says yes to impeachments. This is the third major upset to the country's political status. It will hurt, but we need radical change. A second constitutional Congress, literally. Then we check in with Linda. Let's be clear. There will be no future elections, or at least valid future elections. Republicans will stay in power for years to come if this comes to pass. That is the Project 2025 plan. And what about the supreme jobs? Then we go to Morgan. One comment has floated multiple times in the discussion, to paraphrase, how are they going to feel when the Democrats come in and use these powers? I think that question misses the point. The current administration is not Republican. It is not conservative in a traditional way. It is an administration which seeks to perpetuate itself and its ideology of corruption, aggregation of power, and the dismemberment of our Constitution for the benefit of very few people. On that note, I hope you guys have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you.
Bless you all.
I just would just say the country has been super divided before in history. As much as we all think that this is a unique moment, there have been multiple attempts by sitting presidents to aggregate power, to override the legislative role of Congress. The more that we just make this about division, the less likely we are to solve it. What is needed to solve it is for people on both sides to say, we need to right this. We need to get back to, sane governmental, how the government is run has to be done in a way that is consistent with a balance of powers, not one part of government being superseding other parts of government. And I wish I could be more articulate about that, because I'm just thinking in real time here, and that's always dangerous.
But, well, it's pretty articulate. So.
I don't believe that we're on the verge of a civil war, which is what would happen. I mean, I don't see any way around it. People aren't going to just go, oh, well, I'm not in charge, so I'm just going to let this happen. I don't think impeachment is the path. I think the path is let's like really try and fix our governmental system, starting with primary system, starting with how we do the electoral college vote casting. Make sure people's votes actually count, and they don't right now. You know, if you're a person who's a Republican in New York, your vote for president doesn't count. If you're a person who is a Democrat in Florida and you're close to, not as close as you used to be, but close to half the population, your vote doesn't count. Let's fix that. Let's fix the primary system so that we can elect moderate people who understand what people want, not what their party wants.
Heather Mulligan, Mike Spain, Judy Patrick make up our panel. We will continue that after we take a break and hear news with David Gastina. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you all with us, and we appreciate you being here. Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, Heather Mulligan, and we welcome you, panel@wamc.org. We talked about this just briefly in passing, and a couple of our letter writers brought it up as well, but President Trump announced yesterday, and he'll be rolling this out officially at some events today, a $12 billion bailout for struggling farmers on Monday. He announced as he looks to shore up the finances of some of his most loyal supporters whose financial fortunes have been hurt by his trade war. The rescue package, which was unveiled in an event with farmers at the White House, comes as Mr. Trump's trade policies have hurt America's agriculture sector. While Mr. Trump's plan to raise tariffs was intended to spur domestic production and open export markets, it has actually closed off sales for many U.S. farmers. China, the biggest buyer of American crops such as soybeans, retaliated against Trump's tariffs by halting purchases of U.S. farm products this year. This reporting from the New York Times. We love our farmers, Mr. Trump said at the White House event announcing the payments. And as you know, the farmers like me. Most of the relief funds will come from the Agriculture Department's Farmer Bridge Assistance Program. That word I'm inserting here, but that word bridge will come into play here. There's the way that the administration is using that word. According to the Agriculture Department, the money will go to producers of corn, cotton, sorghum, soybeans, rice, wheat, and other row crops. The payments to the farmers will be made by the end of February. The Trump administration will initially distribute $11 billion and is reserving another $1 billion to support growers of fruits and vegetables as needed. Mr. Trump said that the money was a small portion of the revenue that the United States has been taking in from tariffs. Although he said the tariffs made the payments possible, Mr. Trump's aggressive use of import levies is the primary reason that American farmers need economic support. Let me just say that again. Mr. Trump said that the money was a small portion of the revenue that the United States has been taking in from tariffs. Although he said the tariffs made the payments possible, Mr. Trump's aggressive use of import levies is the primary reason that American farmers need economic support. The payments are not being funded directly by tariff income. Just wanted to make that clear. Mike Spain.
Well, there was a bailout of farmers in the first Trump administration, which I think amounted to $20 billion. And that was because of not being able to come to trade agreements with China. And China stopped buying U.S. soybeans and other grains, and et cetera. And that's really what's going on now. China is buying, you know, because of tariffs and this back and forth about where our trade policies are with China. They're now buying their soybeans and their other agricultural products from South America and other places on the planet. And they kind of don't need the U.S. So we're taking some of the money that was raised by these tariffs that have caused these problems and using it to pay off the farmers. Another interesting fact is the New York Times did an analysis where in the first Trump administration, most of that $20 billion bailout went to large agricultural companies, not just regular farmers. And, you know, that's what's going to go on here. A lot of people are going to get rich. They're going to be paid basically for not doing what they ordinarily do, and that is grow crops and sell them abroad and have a business that's thriving. And what happens next year? Do we have to bail them out again? Because China, you know, has sort of suggested it will start buying more soybeans, but still a fraction of what it had bought before. I mean, it's really throwing the agribusiness in the U.S. into a big, long period of uncertainty and self-inflicted.
I do want to just mention real quick, there was an analysis in the New York Times done by David Sanger, and he talks about Liberation Day in April and where we've come from that point to now, and then in announcing the bailout. And in this analysis, he said on Tuesday the president will go to Pennsylvania for the first time of what the White House calls a series of speeches addressing the affordability problem, which last week he dismissed as the greatest con job ever conceived by Democrats. China, the world's second largest economy, and the U.S.'s main economic and technological competitor, released figures on Monday showing that it continues to run a record trade surplus with the rest of the world, even as its overall trade and surplus with the U.S. narrows. Also, that Mr. Trump insists that his signature decision to impose the highest tariffs on American imports since 1930 is working or will soon. He continues to blame his predecessor, Joseph Biden, for every economic woe, though the argument is getting thinner and thinner as he approaches in 6 weeks his first anniversary in office. He finds himself roughly in the place Mr. Biden did in early 2024, telling the American people that they are doing great when many don't feel that way. He has dismissed talk of high prices at grocery stores, insisting they are coming down, but inflation edged upward in September to about a 3% annual increase, almost exactly where it was when his predecessor left office. And then as far as the job numbers, as far as the Bureau of Labor Statistics, all those numbers, according to the president, are rigged. And he is, my final point here, he is saying that this is a victory. This $12 billion is a victory, another piece of evidence, at least to him, that his decision to impose the highest tariffs on American imports since 1930 are working or will soon. In recent weeks, he has promised to use the tariff income flowing into the country to cut a government check of $2,000 for every taxpayer, not including high-income people, he exclaimed on Truth Social. Last week, he declared at a cabinet meeting that at some point in the not too distant future, you won't even have to have income tax to pay.
Interesting.
What
yeah.
do we make of this?
I mean, it'd be awesome to not have to pay income tax. I'll start with that. I just want to say, on the bailout thing, there's a fine history of the U.S. government bailing out large sectors when they get in trouble. Sometimes the trouble is not inflicted directly by government. Sometimes it is. But the agricultural sector is very important. And I think it's very unfortunate that these new markets are being accessed by the large consumers. Take soybeans. I can assure you that the environmental laws and the labor laws that apply in the countries that are now benefiting from the fact that our farmers are not the primary sellers of soybeans to China, that is not a good thing for the environment. I think keeping agricultural land sustainable and productive is really, really important. I live on an old dairy farm. It's not a dairy farm anymore. It used to have 1,000 acres. We're down to 40, and we now just mainly produce manure, horse manure, and hay. But it's important to maintain the viability of these entities. And so as far as, setting aside for what caused the economic crisis, the idea of helping them out, I don't think is a bad idea. I do think this points to the kind of the mistake of tariffs. If the goal of tariffs is to drive trade agreements that are better for the U.S., that equalize the trade balance, fine. Let's make that happen. But that's not what's happening here. This is now tariffs are good because we're making money off of it. Yeah, off of our own people. That's not beneficial. So I think it's time to really go back to the bargaining table and see if we can get some real trade deals here. And let's put the whole tariff foolishness behind us.
The repeated use of the word bridge by the president and his top economic aides seems intended to signal to Americans that they just needed to hold on and the promised benefits from the tariff plan would pay off. This from David Sanger's piece in the New York Times. Quote, this money would not be possible without tariffs, Trump told a small group of farmers and rice refiners who were brought into the White House for the event yesterday. The tariffs are taking in, hundreds of billions of dollars, and we're giving some up to the farmers because they were mistreated by other countries for maybe the right reasons, but maybe for the wrong reasons.
And let's also realize that out there is the looming Supreme Court decision about whether or not he even has the authority to do the tariffs the way he's done it. I'd like to say that $12 billion is not going to cover all the losses that the farmers are sustaining because of the tariffs. It's probably at one quarter of what they need to go forward. And again, what will happen is these large corporate farms will get most of this money. And the small family that's got maybe 40 acres of soybeans, they're going to be less likely to be made whole. It just seems like lunacy what is happening in terms of the tariffs. What you will hear from Trump supporters, including a lot of farmers, is that this whole idea of, yep, we're just going to hold on. We think that what he's saying makes sense in the long run. There's going to be, as to quote Donald Trump, some short-term pain, but we'll endure it because there's a rain. There's a pot of gold at the end of this rainbow. Prices are up. I mean, I get a number of receipts that include a surcharge for the tariff I'm paying, and it seems like it was not well thought of on Liberation Day. We should have included some provisions for bananas and coffee that we can't grow in the U.S. And that seems to be the way the Trump administration rolls things out. It's like by the seat of their pants.
And meanwhile, Scott Bessent, our Treasury Secretary, announced on Sunday on Face the Nation that he has divested his holdings in North Dakota soybean farmland. I actually just divested it this weekend, he said, as part of my ethics agreement, so I'm out of that business.
Yes, but it's December.
Yeah, it's December. How long has he been in office?
Right. Yes. It's been there since January. Nice.
Well, should we look at that and go, ooh, we should get out of soybeans too?
Well, the
is big there a
question,
financial motive?
Yeah. Depends what your ethics agreement is. Yeah.
No, but, I'm just wondering, like, if he's looking at that and saying, well, obviously the soybeans market's going to tank. I got to get out.
Well, he
it was for ethical reasons that he did it.
Yeah. Well.
No, I mean, what about, okay, so now the farmers will get some aid on this $12 billion bailout, so to speak. But Judy points out most of it won't solve the problem. It won't solve most of the problem. But the what do they do now? Do they not plant soybeans next year? Do they plant something else? What can they plant that they think they can sell and maintain the business that they're in their livelihood?
What do they do with the soybeans they've got now that they haven't been able to ship?
Exactly.
Candles. They'll make candles.
Is that tofu?
Yeah.
Tofu. Yeah.
Tofu. I love tofu.
Going to flood the market with tofu.
There's a restaurant near my house that used to sell tofu bites that they're like deep fried, and then they put this peanut sesame oil on them, and they took them off the menu, and I'm still mad about it. So
I'll watch for it. It'll return.
It'll come back. Yeah, I think now. Yeah. Remember the cheese giveaways when there was just the federal government
the
was
cheese.
Buying up
government cheese.
Yeah. Government soy.
Yes.
Government tofu.
Yeah.
What a public radio thing.
Yes.
We've defunded public radio, but we're going to give you soy.
Tofu for everyone.
Deborah writes, one of the big beneficiaries of the farm bailout will be Scott Bessent, who is an agricultural corporate shareholder. We just talked about that. Also, these billions will not be a long-term aid as long as climate change awareness is non-existent in this administration. That from Deborah. We go to Paul. Shocking to hear a suggestion that the division in our politics is the problem. The division is a consequence of the successful overthrow of rational government in favor of emotional decision making. To suggest a middle ground between rational and emotional decisions simply abandons rational thought. Then we go to Marion. Not paying taxes sounds nice, but we will pay in tariffs and lose services and end up poorer. The shift from income tax to tariffs is a shift of taxes from rich people to poor people. But, well, try to explain that to Republican voters. Then we check in with Carrie. I'm a farmer in Ulster County, not one of the farmers who likes Trump. The unfortunate fact is that small-scale farmers like myself don't get any subsidies, any payments, any direct economic support from the feds, except in the case of severe weather. We feed our neighbors here in New York State, yet Midwestern farmers are being paid for food they probably had to throw away. Do you think those farmers felt good about doing that? Farm policy in the U.S. is absolutely, utterly broken. That from Carrie. And I think we have one more note. Ricky says, is there a way to know approximately how much money the Trump tariffs are actually bringing into the federal government? Is the administration overselling the tariffs as a way to raise money for the federal government? Well, I think that's an interesting point, but those numbers change so quickly, so radically, so often that I think it would be...
Who gives us the numbers? Is it someone who's appointed?
You think?
It's a very good point. It's a very good point.
But the whole tariff thing, Heather, you were explaining it before. Tariffs can be used, or the threat of tariffs, to negotiate trade deals that are beneficial to the U.S. And then those tariffs go down or they go away, depending on what the negotiation produces. What's going to happen next year? All these markets that, just using the trade deficit, the trillion-dollar trade deficit that China has now, I mean, they're not suffering. Even though they're selling 25% less to the U.S., they're selling more everywhere else on the planet, all around us, north of us, south of us, east of us, west of us. And they're not hurting. And they're why should they go back? And why should they compromise to come back and do what we want to do when they're doing just fine without us?
I recently saw a chart on manufacturing in China, and you know they did have a slowdown for a period of time, but they've completely rebounded. And to the degree that the goal is to repatriate manufacturing in the U.S., and there are some good reasons to really want to, especially things that are like high tech, computer chips, that kind of stuff. the goal of repatriating that makes a lot of sense. But we're not going to, like, all of a sudden start making all the you know, clothing. All the clothing again, right? Yeah. I wish that were true, that we could resurrect, you know, the textile industry.
Or the furniture industry.
But, right. Yeah. And those, the loss of those were in part due to very aggressive tactics by the Chinese government to take technology, to buy companies, and to replicate products that were made here, thus putting these companies out of business. Because but all points to the need for rational trade agreements. If you have rational trade agreements, you can normalize and stabilize this. What is going on right now is not having the desired effect. We are not regrowing significantly U.S.-based manufacturing. And what we need to do is figure out how to make it so that the high-end, the high-value manufacturing that has intellectual property that we want to hang on to, that happens here, and focus on that first. And this is just like throwing spaghetti at the wall. I just, it's not having the desired effect.
What is the impact on small business? What are you hearing?
So small, we've surveyed our members.
Just
and,
a minute out.
Oh,
go
sorry.
Ahead. No, you're fine.
We've surveyed our members on tariffs. It is a growing concern. Right now, a cost of healthcare is top of their list, right? Because they want to provide healthcare for their employees. There's, you know, obviously that's the big thing. People aren't really sure how tariffs are impacting them other than things are costing more. And that's the generalized feeling with small businesses, that things are costing more. And, you know, all I can say to people is, folks, go out, shop local, go to a real store, go walk in. Maybe it's not as convenient as sitting, you know, on your couch and ordering something and having it delivered the next day. But go out and support your local small business, because they need you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you, panel at WAMC. Caprichosos, te llevan para las villas. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've got about a half hour left with our terrific group of Judy Patrick and Mike Spain and Heather Mulligan. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. .org. We just received, there's this news in that a federal judge ordered the release of grand jury materials in the case against Ghislaine Maxwell, saying that public access to the records is required by the Epstein Files Transparency Act that Congress approved last month. The U.S. District Judge said the new law also covers voluminous other records from the case generated during pretrial proceedings, including evidence that was not used at Maxwell's trial. Before release, the Justice Department must redact information that could identify victims of Jeffrey Epstein, the wealthy sex offender whom Maxwell was convicted of assisting, according to the judge. Maxwell, a longtime romantic partner to Epstein, was convicted in federal court in Manhattan in late 2021 for her role in trafficking underage girls. Prosecutors argued Maxwell was Epstein's top enabler, finding young, vulnerable victims.
Do you think that information really will come out anytime soon?
No. Anyone else?
Do you think it will be heavily redacted?
Yes.
With,
yes.
It will
well,
be
so, besides just the victims.
Besides just, I mean, we could get full-scale black lines throughout the whole thing. It'd be interesting. I mean, releasing grand jury minutes probably does take an act of Congress in this case. It's something that's highly unusual. And I don't know how in-depth the prosecutors went when they were working with the grand jury, how much information they actually gave them. Do you think they were exhaustive? Could be. I mean, they were trying to get people on the record when you do grand jury testimony, correct?
Yeah.
But doesn't grand jury, all the grand jury information include a lot of things that are hearsay, that are not proven, that are just piled up, used, you know, piled up during the investigation, and then they use the real stuff.
I mean, it's the evidentiary standards are not the same as the trial, but also just the goal is different, right? A criminal trial, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. grand jury is more likely than not. It's more probable than not that a felony was committed, and more probable than not that this is the person that committed it. That's the two elements of grand jury. It's a completely different standard, which, I mean, so you can say a lot of things in grand jury that would certainly not be admissible at trial for good reason, right? That mm-hmm. they're just statements that are unverified, unvalidated. So, you know, it's a little scary. The idea of the release of grand jury testimony, because I think to someone who's, you know, not an attorney, you might think, well, this was grand jury testimony, right? It's evidence. It's and so it's not. And I don't know. I worry for Ghislaine Maxwell's life. I'm joking, but half joking. I mean, I just wonder how much more pressure will be brought to bear on her to, you know, get her on camera. And this whole thing is just, I don't know. It's clear that it's divided the Republican Party to some degree, and that is an interesting element of it. But there's definitely things that probably we're going to find out that are not good at some point.
You know,
I couldn't be more vague than that.
when they were pushing for the release of the Epstein documents, I was never quite clear what we were talking about. I mean, maybe we'll get grand jury testimony from Epstein's indictment. But I was thinking what we would be getting would be FBI interviews with people, with all the victims in the case. That's what I was thinking would be out there.
And I should be clear, like, testimony in the grand jury is under oath, right? Mm-hmm. It is sworn testimony to the degree that any testimony in court is sworn, but it's not subject to cross-examination. So there's no ability to question the facts or challenge what's in there. The defense attorney can't ask questions of the witness. They can sit there in the grand jury while their client testifies, but that's it.
They can be there, but they can't participate. Well, it's the famous quote about a grand jury and Saul Wachtler. Yes.
Yeah.
a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. A DA knows how to use a grand jury to get an indictment. Yeah.
All right. Changing gears a little bit. President Trump said in an interview published on Tuesday that Europe was weak and its nations were decaying, days after the Trump administration issued a strategy paper that indicated that the U.S. should no longer guarantee the continent's security. The president's comments, made in a wide-ranging interview with Politico, widened a dispute between Mr. Trump and his European counterparts over Europe's future and how to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Mr. Trump said that President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who has rejected parts of the U.S. proposal for a ceasefire, would have to, quote, get on the ball and start, quote, accepting things. Mr. Zelensky's army is losing the war, Mr. Trump said, suggesting that it was time for him to compromise in the ceasefire talks. Mr. Trump's intervention was published a day after the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany met with Mr. Zelensky in London to show their support for Ukraine and discuss alternative ceasefire plans. Mr. Zelensky reiterated that the meeting that Ukraine would not budge from its longstanding opposition to handing over land to Russia requirement of Mr. Trump's proposed peace plan. Mr. Trump also accused Mr. Zelensky of not having read a new draft of the American peace plan. It would be nice if he would read it, Mr. Trump said. You know, a lot of people are dying, so it would be really good if he'd read it.
So, like, caps, all caps?
Well, this was in the article, so,
I
think they probably took the cap lock off, but I don't know.
Do you think he read it?
You know, that was my immediate question, Judy. It's a good one.
You know, my hat's off to Zelensky and the European leaders. You know, they're going to ice the U.S. out, even though I know that that's impractical. But Zelensky's saying, no, we're not going to give up our land. It may not be a militarily practical solution to the end of this war, but I mean, I got to give him credit because the bullies are pushing Ukraine around, and they've held firm for, 4 years now? It's true. People are dying, but Europe is rightly concerned about where America stands in terms of its support. It's nice to see the European countries step up and commit to doing more to protect themselves. It's sad to see we as a country stepping back from our role as the leader of the free world, but that's where we are right now.
Also where we are, Mr. Trump, the president, said he would not rule out an American ground invasion of Venezuela, which he repeatedly threatened with military action inside the country and accused of sending drugs and criminals to the United States. As for President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, whom the Trump administration has labeled the head of a terrorist organization, his days are numbered, Mr. Trump said, according to the transcript of the interview. Later, Mr. Trump said he had watched footage of the September 2nd military strike on a boat in the Caribbean that killed survivors of a previous attack on the boat, which the administration has said was involved in drug trafficking. Mr. Trump said about the footage, "It's not pretty."
Yeah, I think he's getting ready to cut ties with Hegseth. That's what it sounds like to me. he's kind of like taking little side steps away from him. That's what it feels like. There's no justifying that. Right. And I think the video footage is going to get out and they know it.
Well, Trump said he would have no objection to it coming out. And now he's saying he didn't say that. And it's up to Hegseth. But I think that's another stepping away, as you say.
Also, how does that happen? I mean, I understand that he's the secretary, but that you decide your own fate in this.
Well, I mean, ordinarily, his people can do really stupid things and say stupid things and make mistakes, and he stands by them as long as they're not embarrassing him and as long as they're loyal to him. Well, Hegseth has been completely loyal to him, but I think he, you know, when you go back to the whole Signal chat, you know, thing that involved a reporter planning military operations, and you look at all the other things that Hegseth has done that have been embarrassing to Trump. This could be the one. I agree. I think there is that pattern of sort of stepping away, and you know, we have seen some lower level people step out of the picture. Yeah.
So I would have that is where my money would have been last week. But then when both Republicans and Democrats who saw the footage came out of it with very different views and were not united in their thoughts, I thought, okay, so is this the cover that's needed to save Hegseth? But I don't know. And will there be new? I can't imagine what other new revelations would be that are more damaging than what is already out there. But I've always been surprised by that. So
the one thing that is unanswered is the documentation that all these 84 people, whatever it is, 86 people who've died were actually drug runners, and that all these boats were drug boats headed for the U.S. And how did they know that? And then the whole hypocrisy about why wouldn't you want to capture those guys and find out where the source of these drugs were and verify and go after the bigger fish, so to speak. You know, that whole policy is so riddled with, you know, errors and illogic.
But it does bring us to Hegseth aside. We still have the policy of the president talking about military action within Venezuela, which I just look at and say, okay, where are we going on that?
Yeah, well, we need more information.
Right.
Let's talk about the policy. What is the policy? What's the rationale? And where are the documents? Where's the information we need so we as a country can decide, so Congress can decide? Brief Congress. It does not seem like it's a rational policy. And oftentimes all the time, what we're seeing is policy is whatever he tweets at 2 o'clock in the morning. But then he will, in the case of Hegseth, he will step away when he realizes, oh, we're not supposed to do that. That's a violation of the law to do certain things. This one issue might bring Hegseth down, but the overall policy about Maybe it's just a way of a PR thing of discouraging anybody, any boats from trying to come to this country, even if they're not going to this country.
Well, I'll just say this. When have you ever heard that the U.S. has taken fabricated information or created information to justify the invasion of another country? You know, weapons of mass destruction, does that ring a bell? Right. You know, all we have to do is sort of create a premise and then use the premise, however true or false it may be, to then say, well, it's a threat against humanity. It's a threat against our country. We need to invade Venezuela, you know, and that's worrisome. I mean,
I think the Hegseth thing, setting aside the ground invasion, not that that's not extremely serious and a big problem. I don't think those things are related. I think the stepping away from Hegseth has to do with, I think the footage is going to get out and people aren't going to like it. And I don't want them to not like me more than they already don't like me.
Right.
I mean, I think
right
that's
on
it's
the
as
money.
Basic
yeah. right
as
on
that.
The money.
and so I got to get myself away from this guy because, you know, gee, I used to be friends with him, but now I can't be friends with him anymore because he's done something that people don't like. I don't know. That reminds me of something. I don't know. Epstein, maybe. Mm. But you know, I think there's a pattern there. Don't want to be with the unpopular guy.
Musk.
I gotta get myself away from him. And, you know, hey, you know, it wasn't my decision. He did this thing. He's gotta pay the price for it. The ground invasion in Venezuela is that's a, you know, his geopolitics. You know, it's a threat. I'm going to say it. And, you know, maybe they'll give me what I want, which is what? I don't know.
They may take away your FIFA Peace Prize.
Remember Taco. Trump always chickens out.
Well,
I want a FIFA Peace Prize now. I like now that I know it's real, I feel like. What
well, they've only
do?
Done it once.
Real-ish. Real-ish.
Real-ish.
I wonder well, if I could get on the Tunisian soccer team.
You might.
I know.
You could do that. Yeah, you absolutely could
I'm
do
really,
that.
I played soccer and I'm not good. Just
saying. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up right after this. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable as we finish up our Tuesday meeting of the Roundtable panel on this ninth day of December. It is 49 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome you and your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So we've talked about a lot of interesting issues this morning, and I think we have time for just one more. And this is one that I will admit I am personally fascinated by. No. I have no idea what you know is going to happen here, but it's a mess. So. Last week, we talked about the fact of that Netflix was going to buy Warner Brothers Discovery, and that they had struck an $83 billion deal to acquire the media conglomerate. Well, now Paramount Skydance launched a hostile bid on Monday to buy Warner Brothers Discovery. That took shape under CEO David Ellison, who said it would be bringing an all-cash offer directly to Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders. The unsolicited bid, whose financial backers include President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is for the entire company, wait for it, including CNN and other cable networks that were spun off into a separate company in Netflix cash and stock proposal. Ellison is the son of Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison, one of the world's wealthiest people and a friend and supporter of President Trump. The president said Sunday he would be involved, was the quote, in assessing the intended Netflix Warner Brothers Discovery deal, saying Netflix market share in the streaming sector, quote, could be a problem. In a news release Monday, Paramount Skydance said its bid offers superior value and a more certain and quicker path to completion to Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders, an offer sweetened by $18 billion more in cash. The bid would pay shareholders $30 a share on Friday Network. Netflix said its offer would value the share at $27.75. The shares closed up 4.4% on Monday.
So first of all, as someone who every night tries to remember what streaming service the show I want to watch is on, the idea of consolidating these streaming services into one bundle is an attractive one for me. But I think neither one of these deals is good for the consumer. The Netflix deal will be bad, I think, for the creative production of content. I think Netflix, you will see fewer things. I think, and then at the other end, the idea of, Trump wants to control what is produced by HBO, by all of these services, and the political influence is just so potentially dangerous. No, not potentially dangerous, just dangerous. CNN is a minor actor in this. It's not the most valuable property. Let me just also say that all these consolidations, the problem Warner Brothers is having it from the get-go is the fact that it was bought by AT&T years ago and saddled with all this debt. And these deals will also bring renewed debt. And guess who's going to pay for that debt? You and me, Joe.
Yes.
Rate increases.
And
you might.
All of our, yes.
All our streaming services will go up in price, or there'll be one big, and they said.
But we need them because we're in the media.
That's true. Yeah, I love the fact that over the weekend I was reading all these pieces about how Hollywood was in sort of disarray because of what Netflix would do and what it would mean, and then CNN would be broken out and they'd be independent. Could they survive? And all these different pieces, and then Monday comes along a counteroffer. I guess this is a hostile bid under the technical terms. I wish Mark were here today to explain all this to us. But anyway, I guess Elon Musk did a hostile bid to take over Twitter, and look how that worked out.
Right.
No,
and I think it's also fascinating to see. I mean, the Kushner factor here is huge.
He's a key negotiator of the Ukraine. So we'll go back two stories. Yes, the Ukraine peace proposal, he's big on that, too.
That's Kushner. Right. And so we're seeing that. And then the president saying he's going to be a part of this deal and being an arbitrator or something?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know. And then there's a lot of foreign money coming in to finance these deals, and that's, I guess, worrisome, perhaps, depending on where it is. There's even Chinese money in one of the deals. I mean, these things are very, very complicated, and we're just the consumer, and we have to do whatever happens. We have to pay more for our streaming service or as Judy points out, maybe see a demunization of the quality of what's produced for these. And certainly one of the things that Netflix has done, it doesn't pay what Hollywood studios would pay. It tries to do things on the cheap and churn things out, and there will go quality.
And let's state the obvious here as well. The president should not be involved in these kinds of transactions.
Exactly. Nor should his kids.
Nor should his kids. In a capitalistic society, we don't want the heavy hand of the chief executive of the country, who continues to amass greater and greater powers, putting his finger on what's going to happen. Although, that being said, it could go Netflix way at this point. That's the deal that's been consummated. Mm. I mean, it hasn't been signed at this point. But at the end of the day, again, I wish it was easier for me to keep track of all the shows and all the streaming services.
Meanwhile, in a little bit of what I feel to be good news is that Jimmy Kimmel's ABC deal has been extended to May 2027. So there was some question as to whether he would finish out the year, given that he was kicked off for a while. He has signed a deal with Disney for 1 year. And as far as I would see it, it brings you right into the election, see what happens in the midterms, make a decision if you want to be around for the election cycle in 2028, and go out before or after.
Well, Stephen Colbert is still only on until May, so we'll have
to
see.
He will be off in May.
But I mean, wouldn't you think HBO would be there knocking on his door?
Yeah, maybe.
I would think everyone would be knocking on his door, depending on who owns that company at the end of the day.
Yes, right.
You know, this is after these guys ran afoul of Donald Trump, where they said things that he didn't like. And this weekend, 60 Minutes aired an interview with Marjorie Taylor Greene that Donald Trump didn't like. And he has made his displeasure known to the people who run the company who are trying to acquire Warner Brothers. And so, you know, every day there are minefields that these companies have to navigate when it comes to keeping
right
in the good graces of the President of the United States.
And none of this is going to stop anytime soon.
Just like you would like a chart, Judy, that would tell you which program is on which streaming service, et cetera, et cetera. I think it would be interesting to say which company owns which sub-company, you know, Paramount, CBS, HBO, this. Who owns CNN? I guess HBO now. I mean, all of this, it's so hard to know who's in charge of all this media that we're being bombarded with.
We'll call it there. My thanks to everyone for being with us. Heather Mulligan, Mike Spain, Judy Patrick, and you. We appreciate it. We'll be back for another hour right after this.